Good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today. And joining us now, it's a pleasure to welcome Sam Polk. He is the author of a new book, For the Love of Money, a memoir, For the Love of Money by Sam Polk, P-O-L-K. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
Not a typical business book, but a book that really gives a pretty good idea of what seems to go on Wall Street. And you talk about how you got into the position on Wall Street, and it's really a book about addiction as well, as the title might indicate. But I want to go back because yesterday, September 15th, was the anniversary of the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. You were, I believe, trading at a hedge fund at that time, correct?
That's right.
Do you remember the day?
Oh, I remember it like it was yesterday. I mean, one of the things that most people don't know is that Lehman Brothers was one of the largest derivatives players in the market. And so when they went down, that meant that every hedge fund, every bank, everybody that had derivatives contracts on with Lehman suddenly lost those positions. So imagine if you had, you know, hedged one of your commodities positions, for example, and then all of a sudden your hedge just one day disappeared. And so that the Sunday of that weekend, I got a text from my boss, who was the head of trading at one of the largest hedge funds in the world, to come in for an emergency trading session. So that day, you know, everybody in Manhattan was a church except for Wall Street traders, derivatives traders specifically, who were in their desks, in their seats at their desks, trading billions of dollars worth of credit derivatives and any other kind of derivatives on a Sunday. Never before had it happened.
There must have been a lot of people who were very scared at that point.
I think we all were scared. It was like the foundations of the earth that we were all standing on suddenly began shaking and then crevices opening inside them.
And for people who are so attuned to money, who love money, what was the impact on that? And what did you learn from that day?
That was a big moment in the path that led me to leave Wall Street. And here's why, is that, you know, for one, you know, I don't know if you remember that year, but it was crazy. Everybody was down money. Every major hedge fund was down 20%. All the bank stocks were down 50%. And nobody had seen this coming. People would say things that sort of subtly moved responsibility away from them. They would say, look, this is like a 100-year flood. You know, you would have never seen it coming. But the whole thing sort of bummed me out because it seemed like it was our job to see it coming. And if we hadn't, as an industry, sort of what did that say about all of us who, you know, theoretically our jobs were to predict stuff like this? So on one level, I was really disappointed in the industry. And the other part of me, you know, saw a side of people that I didn't like to see. And what I mean is that, you know, Wall Street culture is all about the value of meritocracy, the smartest rise to the top, we're the best of the best, et cetera. But that year, with everybody down money, it was almost like the truth was revealed. And people that had talked about meritocracy for years all of a sudden were demanding the same bonuses they had received the years before, even though they had lost money and that their companies were on the edge of bankruptcy. And I don't mean to say this like I sat there smugly in judgment of people. Like, I also had this judgment of myself, you know, this feeling like, wow, if this is so scary to me, who has, you know, plenty of savings in the bank, imagine how much harder it is for that, you know, working mom of two kids who doesn't know where her next paycheck is going to come from. Imagine how scary this disastrous economy is going to be for her. And it sort of opened my eyes to how self-centered I was, but also our industry was.
You talk about the meritocracy of Wall Street, yet in many ways, the descriptions that you give are really almost more of a reckless frat house.
Yeah, I mean, it totally is. It's like, you know, it's funny. It's like, I feel like people in power, you know, often create rationalizations to explain why they have when others don't. And so I think meritocracy is the way that Wall Street defines that. But when you look at it, you know, what you see is really a meritocracy amongst, you know, elite, affluent, educated folks. And that's not to say that they're not skilled, but it does say that, you know, whenever you draw not from an entire talent pool, but only from a small subset, you are going to be sort of by definition limited. I think that's definitely true for Wall Street. I definitely think Wall Street is not as smart as many people sort of give credit for.
In fact, I would have to say that your first internship on Wall Street, which was a starting point for you, it didn't seem to be particularly based on meritocracy. You weren't necessarily the brightest kid in your class. You didn't have the best grades. You didn't, I don't know what you did to impress in the initial interview. In fact, you talk about the interview that you didn't even speak a word.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of an understood truth on Wall Street that if you make it into an internship, then it's almost like the vetting of your intelligence has been done, mostly because Wall Street only recruits from the top universities in the country. So I was coming in from Columbia University. You know, they could see my SAT scores, et cetera. Like people, they felt confident in people's intelligence. And so really what it comes down to in terms of whether or not you get a job is how well you do socially. And that was, you know, you said the word frat culture, and it really is a frat culture. I mean, that first summer, you know, people would just say over and over, you know, Wall Street works hard, but we also play hard. And how well you do on the desk is not just about how many bonds you trade and how much money you make, but also how you do at night with clients, whether it's at bars or ball games or whatever.
Let's talk about how you found your way to Wall Street. You grew up in California, right? Southern Cal.
Yeah, I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles. And, you know, my dad was really this Willie Loman type guy, a sort of out of work salesman who had these enormous dreams about making it big someday. Dreams that were very distant from the truth of our lives, which was, you know, rented cars and rented homes and junky cars and, you know, power being turned off because we hadn't paid the bills. And, you know, I did not grow up in a happy family, and there was a lot of angst between my mom and my dad. And, you know, really the only thing as large as my dad's ambition was his anger. And so, you know, I grew up hearing from him, you know, about this fantastical place of, you know, what happens when you become rich. And what it felt like to be in my body was I was this scared and, you know, insecure, overweight kid who sort of didn't feel safe in the world, let alone, you know, feel safe in his house. And so, for me, from a very early age, this idea of getting rich and that how that was going to fix everything, you know, really became my core belief.
You ended up going to San Francisco, working for a while with a startup there. That did not work out. In fact, it ended pretty poorly.
Yeah, I mean, I think jobs is one of the things I've learned in my years is that anytime you punch somebody in the face on company property, it's not really going to be a good result. I was 19. I was living in San Francisco, and I had this great job at an internet company during the .com boom. But at night, I was, you know, going out with this crew of friends to, you know, clubs and bars and doing a lot of, you know, bad things, basically. And you know, it really caught up with me. And I always think about that job because a lot of my story is about Wall Street, but it's also about the other ways that I basically tried to fill the spiritual hole inside with, you know, drugs and alcohol and women and then ultimately money.
Well, it seems as if there is a very small chasm between substance abuse and really an addiction to money. And I think you kind of portrayed that somewhat in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think the nature of addiction is, you know, this, You're trying to fill some hole inside you, some brokenness. You're trying to fix it with something outside you. And the desire for that substance becomes so great and all-consuming that it's almost like you forget about, you know, how your actions impact other people. And, you know, in a very real way, you become incredibly selfish. It's why the, you know, dad will, you know, take money from his wife that should be feeding the kids and go out to a bar. It just becomes the ultimate thing. I do think that, you know, both in my New York Times article about wealth addiction and also this book, I'm, you know, really trying to show exactly what you said, that there's a real, you know, it's almost like there's this perceived difference. Like, people don't think that alcoholics and drug addicts are the same as greedy, wealthy people. But there's a lot of similarities, you know, and you can see it in our culture to this day where you have, you know, an incredible concentration of wealth at the utmost extremes of our society. And it's almost like they're, you know, accumulating and accumulating. For what reason, I don't know, maybe to fill that hole, but they do seem sort of unconscious of the pain that's being caused around them by that.
And how did you slip into that particular addiction? Because you managed to get out of the substance addiction, but then you slipped over into the addiction with money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, if you think about the kind of people that Wall Street draws, right? Like, you're a kid graduating college, and especially if you're graduating Harvard or Columbia or Cornell, you really have your choice of what to do. You could, you know, go be a lawyer, you could be a doctor, you could become an academic. And, you know, that is a really interesting time of life, right? It's almost terrifying, at least in my experience, of like stepping to the edge of the world and trying to figure out where you belong. And so Wall Street, you know, draws people that seem, and this is true for me too, less concerned with what we were doing for the money and much more concerned with the rewards that we would get for doing that. So, you know, I think it draws by its very nature people that are much more interested, not in sort of pursuing their passions, but in the rewards. And then, of course, you put people like that, like me, on a trading floor. And if you think about what's crazy about a trading floor, it's like most jobs, there's like various levels between, like, if you started at, you know, Procter & Gamble, you know, or McKinsey, for example, the consulting company, like, you wouldn't hang out with the CEO. But a trading floor, everybody sits together. So you literally, you know, your first year, my first year, I made $55,000 a year and then a $40,000 bonus. And I'm literally sitting next to guys that are making $2 million every year. And so it's almost like by putting that so up close in your face, and that's one of the reasons, by the way, that, you know, people on Wall Street make $800,000, but they feel poor, is because all of a sudden you're sort of in this, you know, secretive, cloistered world of Wall Street. And, you know, we all judge things on a relative basis. And on a trading floor, somebody that makes a couple hundred thousand is basically a loser when it comes to money.
Most people hear that and think you're crazy.
Well, by the way, I think it's crazy too. I mean, I'm here to say that, like, I left that world, and I think it's absurd. I mean, one of the things I wrote in my New York Times article was that my last year on Wall Street, I made more money than my mom, a nurse practitioner midwife, had made in her entire career. But I also say that just in hopes of people understanding. And I mean, I know this is an unpopular thing to say, but, you know, people on Wall Street get vilified and caricatured. And I am a outspoken sort of critic of the culture of Wall Street and things that need to change and of the widening inequality in our country. At the same time, some of the most generous, kind people I've ever met continue to work on Wall Street. Mm. And, you know, I think that there's space, like, we all contain multitudes, and we have a tendency to sort of see the worst in people.
Hang on, we will continue the conversation. We're talking with Sam Polk. He's the author of a new book, For the Love of Money, a memoir. And we'll continue the conversation in just a moment. Thank you for joining us today. Our guest is Sam Polk. He is the author of a new book, For the Love of Money, not a typical business book, rather a memoir of his time on Wall Street and his various addictions, mainly to money. At a certain point, you were dating a woman and she said, "You're not the person I thought you were." You had changed. So you had some advance warning that Wall Street was changing you. This is a book about addiction to money. And with any addiction, you have to hit bottom. What was it that saw you hit bottom?
I mean, if I had to pick one moment, it was during the crash that you were talking about earlier. And I was a senior trader at one of the largest hedge funds in the world. And I was in a meeting with my billionaire boss and several other people. And we were talking about the new hedge fund regulations that Congress was proposing. Everybody in the room thought it was a terrible idea. But I was starting to see, you know, that maybe there needed to be more than was currently in existence. And I said as much. I said, you know, I think this would be better for the system as a whole. The room went absolutely silent, and my boss sort of shot me this scathing look and said, "Sam, I don't have the brain capacity to think about the system as a whole. I can only think about what's good for us and our business." I saw myself in him, and I understood that my entire life was that definition of addiction, that trying to fill something inside me by accumulating more and more, and that here was a billionaire guy who had, you know, 100 times more money, 1,000 times more money than I did. And he was still sort of in the same pursuit. And that was sort of the moment that I really came to realize that I wanted to make a contribution as opposed to just trying to fight my way up this hierarchy of accumulation. But the bigger answer to that question is when that girl dumped me when I was in 22, my first couple of weeks on Wall Street, you know, I ended up getting sober and going into basically therapy. She was a spiritual counselor, so she doesn't like the word therapy, but it was almost like I had a split, like a double life. During the day, I'd be reading the Financial Times and trading bonds and trying to make as much money as possible. And then at night, I'd be talking to this spiritual counselor and, you know, revisiting painful experiences from my childhood and really confronting truths about who my dad was and how much he actually cared about me, or rather didn't. And
your dad at a certain point came into some money, didn't he?
You know, we were super poor our whole lives. And then, you know, dad had started a public relations company that sort of didn't go anywhere. But one of his clients hired him. And so he became this president of a technology company and for years was talking about selling it. And then one day he gave me a call and said, "Hey, we sold the company." I said, "Well, for how much? How much was your stake worth?" And he said, $15 million.
Did he find some happiness in it?
You know, I can't speak for my dad, and especially because we don't talk that much these days. But I will say that from the outside, it did not seem that he became a kinder, sort of more generous person. It almost seemed like he, you know, with more to protect, he got more vicious in trying to protect that.
And you, did you find happiness?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I don't love that question is because I actually don't think it's about happiness. What I've found is work that I care about, that I'm proud of, but also that really sort of expresses who I am in the world in a way that I never could have done on Wall Street. And so I am much more fulfilled in the kind of career that I've chosen. But I also think that life is really about these sort of like spiritual challenges, uncovering parts of yourself and fulfilling potential and trying to understand sort of who you are and what we're capable of, but also how we fit into the world as a whole. And so that's what I'm focused on, sort of more than happiness, so to speak.
And before we started this, I understand that you're the father of a newborn.
Yeah, I mean, talk about happiness. Now that, you know, I mean, the moments of purest joy I have in my life is literally just watching my daughter do whatever she's doing. And before I had kids, I had no idea that you could experience such intensity of love that it was even possible.
For the Love of Money, and that's the new book by Sam Polk, a memoir, For the Love of Money by Sam Polk. Sam, thank you for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.